from Pacifica Network. This is Democracy Now!
So these companies have collected billions and billions of records about virtually every adult, but it's really not just about computers and networks. It's really about a new source of power that the government is tapping into, for which there's very little oversight and very little regulation.
The security industrial complex, from Starbucks to the subway to the sidewalk, you're being watched. They know where you live. They know your friends. Where the data revolution meets the needs of security, there's no place to hide. We speak with Washington Post reporter Robert O'Hara. Then we get the latest news on Nepal, where the king has dissolved the entire government, is rounding up dissidents and killing rebels.
At this moment in Nepal, anyone who has ever expressed a thought in favor of democracy, perhaps even had one in their sleep, are underground, on the run, in peril of arrest, when arrested, in peril of torture, under full martial law, with all criticism banned and the press under complete military control.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A previously undisclosed report from the 9/11 Commission has found that federal aviation officials had received dozens of intelligence reports in the months after the September 11th attacks, specifically warning of the threat posed by al-Qaeda. Despite the warnings, the FAA did little in response to beef up security. This according to a report in today's New York Times. Up until now, the White House had blocked the release of the report that was completed in August, more than 2 months before the November election. 2 weeks ago, the Bush administration quietly placed a classified and declassified version in the National Archives. The FAA considered the threat serious enough in the months before September 11th that the agency distributed a CD-ROM to airlines and airports that cited the possibility of suicide hijackings. But the FAA failed to implement security measures that could have stopped the hijackings. Airport screening procedures for weapons were not tightened, and the use of on-flight air marshals was not expanded. One airline official told the 9/11 Commission that airlines did not want to give up revenue by providing free seats to air marshals. The report, however, finds no evidence that the government had a specific warning of a domestic attack. Up until September 11th, the aviation industry considered the hijacking threat to be more worrisome overseas. On Capitol Hill, Republican lawmakers are attempting to use the September 11th attacks to pass sweeping new immigration laws. The House may approve, as soon as today, a bill that prohibits states from giving driver's licenses to undocumented workers, making it harder to file asylum claims and give the Department of Homeland Security extraordinary powers to build security walls along the nation's borders. The driver's license provision alone could affect millions of undocumented workers who live in the 11 states that allow them to obtain driver's licenses. In addition, the bill would allow the Department of Homeland Security to, quote, waive all laws that could prevent security measures from being put in place along the U.S.-Mexican border. Republican Congressmember James Sensenbrenner said of the legislation, quote, it seeks to prevent another 9/11-type terrorist attack by disrupting terrorist travel. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmember Henry Waxman is criticizing the measure as a, quote, breathtaking grab for power by the federal government. In news on Iran, the deputy commander of U.S. Central Command announced on Wednesday that the military is updating its plan for attacking Iran. Lieutenant General Lance Smith claimed the update was a routine matter. Smith said, we try to keep them current, particularly if our region is active. The announcement came on the same day both President Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice issued new warnings to Tehran.
The Iranians just need to know that the free world is working together to send a very clear message. Don't develop a nuclear weapon. And the reason we're sending that message is because Iran with a nuclear weapon would be a very destabilizing force in the world. And
meanwhile, former UN weapons inspector Hans Blix has issued a warning of sorts to the United States. He says the Bush administration must know if it launches an attack, there possibly could be nuclear retaliation by Iran. In news from Iraq, a senior U.S. general announced Wednesday it was enemy fire that likely downed a British military cargo plane on Election Day. The crash killed 10 people on board and marked Britain's biggest loss of the Iraq War. In other Iraq news, the Bush administration is seeking $400 million from Congress to pay off nations that are helping to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The White House has dubbed the program the, quote, Solidarity Initiative. About one-fourth of the money will be given to Poland. On Capitol Hill, California Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey called on the House International Relations Committee Wednesday to have hearings on her resolution for the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops in Iraq. The Washington Post is reporting there's more information on abuse at Guantanamo Bay. A soon-to-be-released military investigation has determined that female interrogators repeatedly use sexually suggestive tactics to try to humiliate and pry information from the devout Muslims held at the prison. In several cases, the Pentagon has determined female interrogators pretended to spread menstrual blood on the detainees before they said their prayers. Female interrogators also rubbed their bodies against the men, wore skimpy clothes in front of them, made sexually explicit remarks, and touched them provocatively. In Los Angeles, the FBI has joined the investigation into the police killing of 13-year-old Devin Brown. The African-American eighth grader died on Sunday after police fired 10 shots at him. He was driving a stolen car. After a short chase, police say he tried backing his vehicle into a police car. Brown attended a magnet school for gifted students. The FBI was called in to help with the investigation in part due to increasing tension between the LAPD and the city's African-American community. The shooting of Devin Brown came just a week after prosecutors decided not to press charges against a Los Angeles officer who was caught on videotape pummeling an African-American man with a heavy aluminum flashlight. In related news in Chicago, a 14-year-old boy went into cardiac arrest after police shot him with a taser stun gun. The youth lost consciousness and temporarily lost his ability to talk. The boy was shot after reportedly attacking employees at the group home where he lives. In business news, Carly Fiorina has been ousted as chair of Hewlett-Packard. She was one of the most powerful women in the corporate world. And in other business news, Walmart has announced plans to close a store in Canada, where workers were seeking to turn the store into the first unionized Walmart in North America. The world's largest retailer claimed the store closure was necessary because demands from union negotiators would make it impossible for the store to be profitable. It's the first Walmart to close for economic reasons. For years, Walmart has vigorously fought unionizing efforts. 5 years ago, a group of Walmart butchers voted to unionize. The company responded by announcing it would start stocking prepackaged beef and that there would no longer be a need for butchers. Blues for 3+1, music by the late jazz organist Jimmy Smith. He died on Tuesday at the age of 79. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This week in New York, three members of the Malcolm X grassroots movement were arrested in Brooklyn. At the time of their arrest, the three were trying to monitor police activities as part of the group's Cop Watch program. They were attempting to film a police beating. They were stopped and arrested and charged with assault and obstruction of governmental administration. They deny the charges. Citizens trying to monitor the state. But what happens when the state joins with private companies in monitoring you? When you go to the work, stop at the store, fly in a plane, surf the web, you're being watched. They know where you live, the value of your home, the names of your friends and family, even what you read. Where the data revolution meets national security, there's no place to hide. And that's the title of a new book that examines how the government is turning information technologies against its own citizens. We're joined now by its author, Robert O'Hara. He's the reporter for The Washington Post, an associate with the Center for Investigative Reporting. He was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for articles on privacy and technology and a recipient of the 2003 Carnegie Mellon Cybersecurity Reporting Award. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is quite a frightening book, No Place to Hide. Why don't you start at the beginning? What exactly is happening today?
Well, we will start at the beginning, and it's in the early 90s, it goes along with the explosion in computing power. Everybody knows about how cheap and fast and powerful our home computers have become. The same thing happened probably at an even more accelerated rate in the information industry, so that in the 1990s, these private companies were able to collect literally billions of records. And it's hard to believe, but it's an amount of information that few people can really reckon. And they did it primarily to target us for better marketing, to make services more efficient and convenient for us. And to jump forward a little bit, after 9/11, when the government was anxious to prevent another terror attack and we really didn't know what was going to happen next, the information services jumped into the fray and offered their help, and the government reached out to them. And so we had a marriage of the data revolution, which is what I call it, and the homeland security initiatives. And the result was, in effect, the jump-starting of a surveillance, national surveillance system, or a security industrial complex, if you will.
Bob O'Hara, talk about what the government and companies know when you use your cell phone.
Well, the way this works is that as we go through our lives, we leave more and more. We're like comets in a way. We leave a long trail of data behind us. And most of us don't worry about it or think about it because it's become so routine and the information seems so banal because who cares about us, right? When you use your cell phone, you leave a record of when you made the call, who you called, how long you were on the phone, and where roughly you were at the time. The location of the cell phone is becoming more and more precise. So in some places, it might be up to a mile. In some cities, it might be a few blocks. But there's a general location. When you use your ATM card, you're leaving a record of, obviously, where you were, when you used it, the fact that it was you. There's often a video camera shot of you at that location, which we'll get back to in a little bit. But more than that, the banks, as a result of the Patriot Act, have a legal mandate. They're required to watch that transaction. And so they're using artificial intelligence to check whether that's really you using it, to check whether you have ties to unsavory people, to look at the patterns of your financial activity to see if maybe you're trying to perpetuate sort of money laundering or if you have ties to terrorism finance. So if there are any suspicious signs at all, they're sending reports to a very little-known branch of the Treasury Department, which is creating a data mine of all those reports, and there are many, many of them now. And they share them with law enforcement across the country, local, state, and federal law enforcement, as well as the intelligence agencies. When you go to the grocery store and use the discount card, when you go through an automatic toll booth when you call online to get a sweater or a pair of jeans, or if you have an adventurous marriage and you buy something fun, you know, to use privately with your spouse or your mate. Believe it or not, all that stuff is swept up somewhere, and more is available to these information companies to get to know you better, so to speak, or to share or resell. Now, the government doesn't really care about all of that, but it is routinely tapping billions of records about where you've lived in your entire adult life. I mean, I'm talking every house and apartment, all the phone numbers you've had, the cars you've owned. It can know find links between you and me, for example. They can show, by looking into these billions of records, how we're related. If we know somebody who knew somebody that shared an apartment with, you know, somebody we have in common. And they're using these systems really, I believe, earnestly to protect us. I spent time with Viet Dinh, the author of the Patriot Act, John Poindexter, lots of counterterrorism and counterintelligence kind of guys, as well as these private company officials. And I do honestly get the feeling that there's an earnest desire to tap all this information to protect us. But we all know, we've either heard the great Brandeis quote directly or we know this in our guts, which is that we all fear evil-minded rulers, but the real threat in many ways comes from people who are earnest or zealous, but not necessarily sort of completely aware of the ramifications of what they're doing.
You mentioned John Poindexter, Total Information Awareness, that people pretty much beat back, or so people thought. There was such a open revolt across the political spectrum. The idea of John Ashcroft, of John Poindexter recruiting 20 million Americans to spy on each other, the FedEx person, the person who delivers your mail, take a sneak and peek. If you see something funny, report back. But when did this actually start? And in fact, are they really doing it just by another name?
I did spend a lot of time with John Poindexter, and in No Place to Hide, I think people will be surprised at my finding, and I like to think of myself as a pretty tough-minded guy, is there's a human person here. He is a very, very earnest about trying to help the United States, but of course, he's deeply zealot patriot, and he has a view of the world that included thinking about privacy, but in any case, he's a human person. He's somebody that I think we need to take on as human, not sort of as the boogeyman that a lot of people made him out to be. What happened with the Information Awareness Office that he headed at the Defense Department was that people sort of recognized the scope of the ambition of the government. And as a consequence, Congress undercut the funding because they didn't trust him because of his role in Iran-Contra in the Reagan administration. And I won't go into details about that, but I think people recognize the scandal. And they also didn't trust the idea that there was going to be this all-seeing office collecting information about people around the world with what they felt was very little oversight. Now, the thing that's really interesting here is that I spoke to somebody that was working very closely with John Poindexter at a private company called SAIC, and this guy was actually the fellow who invented the concept of total information awareness, and it happened back in the Clinton administration in 1999. And this guy, on the record in the book and on tape for that matter, said that in fact, after Poindexter left the post, that interest in the intelligence community actually increased, and that he was giving more briefings than ever on the concepts and the technology that lay behind some of their thinking of this system. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that the program may be gone, as I say, but it's not forgotten. Components of it are very much alive in the black world, in the classified world. And there are components of it that were killed but continue in other agencies, so that you see there's a program called HSARPA, Homeland Security, Advanced Research Projects Agency, and they're pursuing exactly some of the same kind of things that Poindexter was. There are places there's a data mining operation at the FBI that very few people have paid attention to. The CIA has a program that's similar, and of course the NSA is pursuing a program that involves massive amounts of data. So I would say that the notion of total information awareness being dead is, you know, a lot of people have talked about it still alive, but in fact, I think I've documented pretty clearly for the first time the extent of the research continuing.
We're talking to Robert O'Hara Jr. He is an award-winning Washington Post reporter. His new book is called No Place to Hide. When we come back, we're going to play a clip of a film called Unconstitutional on this issue, and then talk with Bob O'Hara about some of the companies that are doing this data mining, the private corporations that are working more and more closely with the state. Stay with us. The police, every breath you take. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and both satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV as well on Channel 375. And we're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. And for people who are deaf or hard of hearing, we have closed captioning on our TV broadcasts. So you can watch, though we are not watching you. By the way, this latest news just in, North Korea has for the first time publicly claimed it has nuclear weapons. The government announced today it is dropping out of the six-party nuclear talks. North Korea said there's no point to continue negotiations because the U.S. already determined it to be a, quote, outpost of tyranny. We're going to go back now to the issue of the government monitoring its own citizens. We're talking with Robert O'Hara Jr. His book is called No Place to Hide. But before we go back to him, just a clip of a documentary produced by Robert Greenwald called Unconstitutional.
The ACLU is not the only organization that has been silenced by the Patriot Act.
If librarians have been approached by the FBI, they, of course, can't tell you that, because one of the rules in the Patriot Act is that you can't tell, which is terrifying, really.
What it allows the government to do is to come in and subpoena your customer records to find out what books have been checked out or what books they bought. It doesn't allow the bookstore to contact a lawyer to fight it. It's all done through Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and doesn't give us an opportunity to stand up for our customers.
At least when you get a subpoena from a local court because there's reasonable cause to suspect that someone has broken the law and their library records would contribute to the investigation. That's what the law used to be. At least you could tell anybody that you had responded to the subpoena.
And they don't even need reasonable suspicion to obtain records on you. Employment records, medical records, and even banking records.
The government has deputized the banking industry to spy on American consumers. What we see is the possibility that banks, in doing their policing duty for the government, are going to be looking at who we are, finding out more information than they ought to. It's a very profitable place for them because they get to sell information about us. You just wonder, are you giving the wrong people too much authority?
Government agents can now check on who you are sending email to, who you are getting email from, and what websites you visit by claiming it is relevant to an investigation.
It requires no showing that the individual whose records are being sought actually engaged in or had any connection to any kind of terrorist conduct. So it basically makes all of us vulnerable.
When you look at the Patriot Act, you're struck by the fact that many of its provisions are not limited to fighting terrorism. They affect federal criminal law and procedure generally.
Most Americans believe that the Patriot Act was focused on the war on terror, and yet they're surprised to find that there are portions of the Patriot Act that have nothing to do with the war on terror.
An excerpt of the film Unconstitutional, Anthony Romero, the last voice, head of the ACLU, before that former Republican Congressmember Bob Barr, as well as constitutional lawyer David Cole. Our guest in the Reuters studio in Washington, D.C., is Robert O'Hara Jr., a remarkable book he's written, No Place to Hide. Robert O'Hara, you talk in the book about a company called Axiom. You say, you may not know Axiom, but it knows a lot about you. Tell us about this company.
Before I do that, let me make a remark on that film clip. People think that the Patriot Act is the front and center, and it is. One thing that I found, and that some of those same people who appeared on that would confirm, is that if the Patriot Act were to disappear tomorrow, companies like Axiom, ChoicePoint, Sizent, a lot of these companies would continue rushing ahead, and we'd have as difficult an issue to deal with absent the Patriot Act as almost as we do with it, because there are really no rules that govern how the government uses these private companies, so that even if the Patriot Act strips away some of their ability to get records, the private companies would be able to collect them for the government. And in a sense, the government is outsourcing security and intelligence. One other thing before we get to Axiom is that, just to sort of frame this a little differently, people may recall that Eisenhower warned about a military-industrial complex in 1961. It's a great speech. It's very compelling stuff because people will see how much it applies to our era if you change the word military-industrial complex to security-industrial complex. And he warned about unaccountable power, and that's really what we're dealing with here. And it's not, there's no great Hoover that I've identified, but it's a systematic thing that's creating this power so that if a Hoover comes along, it's really going to be able, it's going to make what Hoover did look like amateur hour, as one of my specialists told me. Now, Axiom.
I could only imagine if J. Edgar Hoover got to vacuum up all this information.
No, the power, compared to what they were doing when they were trying to undermine political opponents and anti-war activists and women's rights activists and such, the power to do that now is sort of infinitely beyond what they could do with their paper and the many files that they collected and created. It's really, as I said, it's something, it's awesome to behold. It's not being used in that way now, and I don't see there's a Hoover out there. In fact, as I said before, I believe that a lot of the people that are taking advantage of this are working in the nation's interest, and they're earnest about it. But you have this partnership that is really remarkable, and few of us really understand it. My advocacy here is very journalistic. It's that we come to understand this and deal with it as soon as possible. And by the way, Viet Dinh, the author of the Patriot Act, Bob Barr, of course, who's a very conservative civil libertarian, counterterrorism officials, all sorts of people agree with me exactly, and they advocate this as well. Viet Dinh says the amount of information that's out there is mind-boggling and that the government's use of it is not properly limited. And I just think that's amazing coming from the author of the Patriot Act. Now, Axiom. Axiom's an amazing company based in Little Rock, and they are perhaps the largest aggregator of information about private Americans. And they work on behalf of virtually all the main banks. They work with retailers. They collect information from hundreds and hundreds of sources so that they have these billions of records that help companies to know you better, to find out more about you. And after 9/11, they reached out to former President Clinton and asked him to make a call to John Ashcroft to help out the government's war on terror, and then to help ease the way for contracts.
We're talking to Robert O'Hara, author of No Place to Hide. Now, let's talk about these government, well, you call it the security industrial complex. We are talking about Axiom, also Choice Point, which people may know from the 2000 election, the ones who purged the voter database in Florida of what they said were felons. And, of course, many of them, of the people who should have been voting, were not felons. Choice Point and these other companies like, what is it, Seismic Intelligence, right. Verint, Verifiable Intelligence.
Amazing stuff. I mean, these are public companies. You can go and look at their securities filings and read some of what they do. I did that intensively, and I went to these companies, and I looked at other records and lawsuits and all the stuff I could get my hands on. And the portrait that emerges is that, in effect, what you have, and this is no exaggeration, it sounds a little goofy, but it's true, and I'll explain that in a minute. You have, in effect, the creation of private intelligence services that, in many ways, do what James Bond and his colleagues would have liked back in the 60s movies, except they do it faster and better in terms of finding links among people, establishing patterns, showing tendencies, risk assessment. Choice Point, based outside of Atlanta, has bought 58 companies since 1997. The companies include a genetic repository, biometrics, fingerprint. They are becoming a fingerprint specialist. They've got something like 19 billion records, and they have become, they say, the nation's largest background screener, so that when you try to get a job, there's a chance that the company is going to Choice Point to check your background out. And so if you had if you wrote a bad check, or if you had a bust for smoking pot when you were in college, or drunk driving, or whatever, that kind of background is going to probably follow you forever now, and is going to be instantly available to anybody who's willing to pay the $50 or $100 to check you out. And one fellow who's concerned about it called it that we're moving toward a scarlet letter society where you are branded for life for whatever you did when you were 19 and foolish. But more than that, Choice Point is providing these intelligence services. And when I said I'd get back to it, it's this. I concluded in my book that Choice Point was operating as a private intelligence service, and I was very excited in a sense and kind of awed by the idea of it. I took that to the company before I went to press with the book, and I said, here's what I've concluded you are and that you're becoming. And the company said, well, yes, guess what? You're right. And so using that, as well as more reporting, I wrote a story for the front page of the Washington Post basically declaring them a private intelligence service. And we'll see where that takes us. I think that's the idea that I'm hoping will help people understand that we're not just dealing with a direct mailing list here anymore.
Bob O'Hara, I was just at Heathrow Airport last weekend, and as usual, I was pulled out of the line coming back to the United States. And the security woman...
You're obviously a threat.
The security woman said to me, we would like to dose your body with low-level radiation. Can we have your permission, please? And I said, what are you talking about? Is this a joke? And she said, no. Can we have your permission? We'll do a low dose of radiation through your body. And I said, hell no. I said, would you do this? And she said, no. So I said, well, then I would like to go back in the line. She said, well, now that you've refused, we're going to do a particular, almost a body cavity search or something. I said, yeah, you can do anything, but I'm not going to get my body dosed with radiation. And she said, okay, that is your choice. I said, will it be our choice in 3 months or 5 months? You're saying this is a test now. But do you know about this? And then can you talk more broadly about the airlines and these lists?
I don't know anything about that, but I will tell you that I find it outrageous in the extreme. And an interesting thing about the book here is that a lot of people talk about privacy and such, and I've written a lot about that. But as I've focused on this more and more in the last several years, I realized that it's not really about privacy. It's about this thing that we have known about for a couple hundred years in the United States, which is autonomy, this notion to be free from people meddling with us and messing with us. And to me, that's one of those things where if you say no, somehow you're suspect. But, you know, my response to that is go to hell. To me, a lot of this, the data collection, the use of it in ways that no one bothered to tell us about, the targeting us even for marketing or including us into special deals or discounts or whatever, and then especially the government using it in ways that we don't understand, is really about autonomy. And it reminds me of when I was a little kid in Indiana hearing my relatives say, who gave them the right? And it could have been about any issue, but to me it's, who gave them the right to do this? Why aren't people telling us what's really happening here in terms of the data collection and the scrutiny of us as individuals and letting us engage in a real honest debate about the parts that we really want to make us safer and the parts where there needs to be limit on these kinds of intrusions.
Hmm. What about RFIDs, radio frequency identification chips?
Well, RFID is a classic example that holds for a lot of this technology. It has a real use, just like the information that we've been talking about has a real use, and we like a lot of it. We like the discounts, we like the conveniences, and in fact, I would argue that we have to use information technology to make us safer to some degree. RFID is like that. It can be used to tag pallets of goods that are going from California to New York. And what it allows the logistical managers to do is to wave a wand over the RFID chip, and the chip will have an ID code on it that bounces right back, reflects the radio frequency, and the ID chip will tell you where the pallet of goods came from, where it's supposed to go, what's there, what's in it, because the ID that's on that chip is also in a computer that has all this information. The thing that's interesting is that for all that utility, RFID is going to be used more and more on people and on IDs. And what it's going to do is accelerate the collection of information about people. So once RFID becomes more common, there's going to be readers presumably in doorways at airports. So when you go through with your ID, it'll automatically record that Bob O'Hara is there at a certain time. These readers, presumably and almost surely, will be placed into doorways where we're not told they're there. Initially, we will be, but eventually they'll become so common that we're just going to get used to them, and we'll forget to ask, are there RFID readers here? So that as we go about our lives, it won't be just cameras, which exist in far greater numbers than ever before, or the data, which exist in far greater numbers than ever before when we swipe our cards, use our credit card, and so on. It'll be these RFID readers that automatically record as we move about in the world. Now, again, there's security there because there's a certain level of security because they're going to know who's coming and going. But the question is, how are we going to limit the use of the information that's collected? And how are we going to ensure that the government and these private companies aren't being intrusive and undermining this sense of autonomy that I would argue we must have in a free society so that we can be politically active, so we can be creative, so we can be different if we choose to be without being made to feel odd or peculiar.
Bob O'Hara, can you talk more about biometrics like iris scans and fingerprinting?
Sure, the same thing. An RFID chip is something that you carry with you, or in some cases people are having, believe it or not, embedded in their bodies. Biometrics is something that you don't even have a choice.
Wait. Embedded in their bodies.
Yeah, there are RFID. People will recognize that their dogs have these RFID chips in them in case the dogs go missing. And in some cases, it's a requirement. You have to have this thing, and it's injected in, and it's a chip that's embedded under the skin. Well, there's a company that has started doing this now for a number of different reasons. And it's kind of funny. They argue that it's to contain medical information. And they argue that if you put it in your children, if they go missing, that it'll help you find them more quickly. But the reality is, and I know this because I've reported on it, is that it's moving toward a general identity system where if you have that on your embedded in your skin or on an ID card, you're going to be able to get through the line, whether it's at work or the airport, and such eventually more quickly than the people who choose not to do it, just as you chose not to have this radiation infusion, whatever that was, that cost you time. It made things inconvenient because you opted not to do it. In the same way, if you choose not to have the RFID on a card or embedded in your skin, you're not going to get through the fast line. Now, biometrics. It's the same sort of thing. I would argue in our lifetimes, we're going to have to share our fingerprints on ID cards and electronically to get into facilities, to go through the airport, to get into buildings. And that's just a fact of life. It's a biometric is an immutable characteristics like a fingerprint, your face, your voice. These are things that, for the most part, people can't mimic. And it's an identity system. And the question isn't the use of the biometric, because the reality is biometrics could actually help prevent identity theft because it's hard to imitate someone's face to take on that identity. But once you have an identity system like that, that where a biometric is used universally, whether it's your fingerprint or your face print, once again, it creates enormous opportunities for private companies to track you or to watch you for, you know, mercantile purposes in ways that weren't possible before. My argument is, how can we adopt the one which could help us without having rules to limit the use of the other, which is the tracking part of it? Why do I say that? It's a very simple, very old-fashioned idea. In a free society, we want people to be as nonconformist as possible. We want people to sort of feel free to express political opinions that are unpopular. We want them to be artistic. We want them to, you know, just be themselves. When you have a sense of being watched, a watched society where biometrics are used to watch everywhere you go, where your data is picked up, at some point we begin to realize in a way that we haven't to date how much we're being watched. And there'll be the people who don't care and they'll do whatever. But the reality is the rest of us are going to feel this chill that maybe if we misstep, we could be taken away for questioning, that, you know, it might be recorded that we did something foolish. And so to avoid embarrassment or those kinds of questions or the sense that we're somehow suspect, we're going to all become a lot more conformist, which I think, I know it seems amorphous, but I find that a tragic idea.
Robert O'Hara, tell us very briefly, we only have a few more minutes, there's so much to talk about, but who Hank Asher is?
Well, thank you for asking about Hank. I spent a fair amount of time with him, and he's an amazing character, just in purely in terms of readability, to kind of plug the book here for a second. We end up talking about computers and data and government power and all that, but at root here is you have these amazing characters and their stories that help understand this data revolution that we've going through. Hank Asher was a data pioneer, and he invented two systems now that have helped change the landscape of law enforcement, surveillance, and the delivery of information about Americans. He created the system called DBT that was sold to Choice Point that was used in the Florida election. And he started out with almost nothing in the early 1990s and created a system that collected when he sold his system and became wealthy in the late 1990s, it had 8 billion records. Well, now DBT is part of Choice Point, which, of course, has something like 19 or 20 billion records. He also, after 9/11, had a company called Seismic Intelligence. Its name was Seisint, and it created a system called The Matrix. A lot of people would have heard about The Matrix because it, for the first time, to my knowledge, combined criminal investigative records and confidential investigative records from police and law enforcement and driver records and photographs with these 20 billion records that, you know, showed where we lived and the cars we owned and the assets that we have. And it did it in a way where I could make a query if I were a cop that had a partial license plate, a description of, you know, that I'm a white guy with 6 foot with brown hair, and a general location, and come up with everybody that fit that description within the snap of a finger. It was an amazing, amazing system. Now, Hank Asher is an especially interesting character because in interviews with me, he acknowledged that in the early 1980s, for a short time, he was a drug smuggler and flew to and from South America and Central America with drugs. He didn't specify, but I obtained records under Freedom of Information that showed that the drugs, according to police, appeared to be cocaine and lots of pot. Hank Asher said that that was a short period of his life. He was an adventurer, and that he hadn't done it since, and there's nothing to indicate that he has. What's interesting is that after he built the Matrix system, spending at least $10 million and perhaps as much as $20 million of his own money, he was invited to the White House and escorted there by the president's brother, Jeb Bush, to demonstrate this system, which, in fact, from what I can tell, is a mind-blowing technology for Vice President Cheney, for soon-to-be Homeland Secretary Tom Ridge, and for others in the White House, in the Roosevelt Room. And after that, received funding from Homeland Security to help expand the use of this. Now, the Matrix system is one of those things that a lot of people think was killed because a number of states dropped out, both for concerns about privacy and the intrusion, as well as the cost. But the reality is some states are still using it. And more importantly, in last summer, Hank Asher's company was bought by LexisNexis, this giant company that nobody thinks of really in this realm because we all use them to get newspaper clips. But in fact, LexisNexis is one of the main players in the war on terror and is sharing its information under contract with the government. Now they bought the Matrix system in Hank Asher's company, Cizant, for $750 million. And it's a sure thing that the Matrix technology is now being used for Homeland Security, and I would argue, I'm betting, I don't know this for sure, that it's going to be interwoven into the much larger, vastly larger company, LexisNexis, which has, you know, a global scope because it's based out of the UK. And so it just becomes this incredible, fascinating story that sounds like science fiction or Hollywood, but in fact is truer than most people probably want to recognize.
Robert O'Hara, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us and for writing this book. Doesn't make you feel very comfortable, but it's important information. No place to hide.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Robert O'Hara, Jr., No Place to Hide. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Jill Scott, watching me here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As international attention continues to remain firmly focused on Iraq, the Middle East, and the tsunami, there is another volatile situation reaching a boiling point in Nepal.
Prajatantra samaksha atankabadle tersayako ekdalya.
The Nepali king appearing on Nepali state-run TV network 9 days ago, announcing a state of emergency. The king sacked the interim government, ordered a shutdown of the country's telephone and internet communications. Newspapers and radio stations were shut down. A ban was imposed on all news reporting. Pro-democracy groups say the move handed total control of the country to the Royal Nepalese Army under the direction of the king. Since 1996, Nepal has faced an armed insurgency by Maoist rebels, operating largely in the countryside and large pro-democracy protests in the capital, Kathmandu. After declaring the state of emergency on February 1st, the king's forces, which include the Nepalese army, began rounding up activists, arresting scores of people, and distributing watch lists of political activists to arrest if they attempt to leave the country. The monarchy and its forces receive significant military backing from the United States, Britain, and India. Pro-democracy activists are now increasing their calls for a ban on military sales to Nepal. We're joined on the telephone by Mary Deschen, an anthropologist and human rights activist who's worked in Nepal for the past 20 years. She's editor of the Kathmandu-based journal Studies in Nepal, History and Society. In our Washington studio, we're joined by Chitrit Tiwari, a journalist and analyst who writes frequently for the Washington Times. He formerly was a lecturer in political science at Nepal's Tribhuvan University, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's turn first to Chitrit Tiwari. What is happening in Nepal right now? Why did the king fire the entire government and the roundups that are going on?
Well, what's happening in Nepal at the moment is a consequence of the long-running insurgency in Nepal. Back in 1996, Maoist started the insurgency, and the insurgency became powerful day by day, and it came to a situation where they imposed a blockade of Kathmandu Valley for two times, and they were succeeding day by day, and the king thought that his position is at stake, and political parties were not able to save his position. As a result, he probably thought that either he has to take command of everything or he will lose his throne. So it's a kind of situation in which actually the monarchy is running out of its time, and in a desperate move, he has taken the action. But I don't think he is going to control the situation in his favor, because the insurgency is turning itself into the revolution. And the problem now is that since the monarchists are, you know, desperate to save themselves from the Maoist takeover, they are likely to use the military force to the fullest extent, inviting a genocidal war in Nepal. That is what is a very disturbing situation on the line. The United States has supplied weapons to the Nepalese army. India has supplied, and so has the British government. Although these governments have denounced King's recent move, but still they are faced with a moral predicament. The king has given the message to these international backers, international friends of him, that either you are with me or you are with the Maoists, which side you are on. So even though there is international outburst, the foreign governments are opposing the king's move, but still there is a chance that the supply of arms, ammunition, could continue there. So this is a major worrying factor at this moment.
Mary Deschen, anthropologist and human rights activist, can you talk about the background to all of this? When did this all begin?
Yes, you can. As in many of these protracted situations, you can go back to several points. The most immediate point is 2001, with the massacre of the reigning king and his family. After which this current king has taken over. The larger and longer struggle that I hope we can talk about a little bit is one for any semblance of democracy in Nepal, which should date back to 1949, when the political parties, some of them were formed a little earlier than that, but was really forming in the first what's called a revolution in Nepal, took place in 1950, which ironically put the grandfather of the current king back into power. He had been locked up in his palace for 100 years prior to that. But speaking for the moment with the present, it's very crucial to understand first, I think, that this is a military coup, the fact that the supreme commander-in-chief of the army happens to be also a king does not change that fact. One of the two key reasons to really keep that at the forefront. One is the sorts of international obligations that kick in because this is a military coup. And the second is that there's a strong effort going on, a PR effort going on by the king and the palace to normalize and legitimize what he has done and to act as if there is some sort of normal and acceptable and even democratic governance going on in Nepal. Those things are entirely false, and if the international organizations and governments accept it, as Chitra has said, we're heading for an even harsher, and he, I believe, used the word genocidal war in Nepal.
Mm-hmm. What about the U.S. role, Britain's role, India's role?
Well, up to in 2002, the United States started to really jack up its ramp up its military aid, and the UK and India have followed and cooperated. There was a strong campaign against that at the time. I was very active in organizing academics here in the United States, and so at that point looked very closely into what the United States argument was. Their logic was quite clear, or their illogic, which is that the way to deal with the insurgency, as they say, or deal with the Maoist problem, was a two-pronged approach in which you try to whip them militarily, and there comes the logic of pouring in arms, which has been going on. And the second is that you have a hearts and minds campaign, and we all know that term from Vietnam. So there's been money going into NGOs and INGOs claims that they're going to actually develop extremely poor parts of the country, and they've been putting in roads. All so-called humanitarian aid has become counterinsurgency aid over the last few years. It's a crucial thing. Now, this sort of strategy, simply aid, does not work. That was part of our point, and will only exacerbate the war. But that has been ignored, and that's the tack that's been taken. Now one hears the Brigadier General Deepak Gurung, who is the spokesperson of the Nepal Army, repeating precisely that kind of line about what they are now going to do, that they are going to attack even more heavily militarily on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you have the king coming out with his 21-point poverty alleviation program.
I want to end with Chitra Tiwari and ask, we only have about 30 seconds, but what do you think needs to happen right now?
What needs to happen right now is that the king's government should be told in unequivocal terms that human rights violation would not be accepted, that international community has a role to play. Any use of the arms supplied to deal with the insurgents is likely to be used against the civilian population. You know, of the 11,000 people killed, 75% of the people have been killed by the army of the king, and this position is going to be increased. That being the case, either the arms has to be stopped or anything that is in the pipeline has to be put on hold.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll certainly continue to follow developments in Nepal. Chitra Tiwari, Washington-based journalist and analyst, born in Nepal. Mary Duchenne, anthropologist and human rights activist, worked in Nepal for the last 20 years. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Friday, February 11th, I'll be in Phoenix, Arizona at the Grace Lutheran Church. Saturday evening, Olympia, Washington, Evergreen College. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Ananagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.